heroic Ukrainian Cossack Taras Bulba dies at the hands of his enemies, but not before he's uttered a great prophecy for the Russian people. A czar shall arise from Russian soil, and there shall not be a power on earth who will not submit to him. The close of the three-part rhapsody for orchestra by Janáček, Taras Bulba, which he wrote during the First World War. It was performed live here at the BBC Proms at the Royal Albert Hall by the European Union Youth Orchestra, conducted tonight by Matthias Bammert, who stepped in not long ago to replace Sir Colin Davis, who was due to conduct the orchestra tonight. The EU Youth Orchestra playing in front of a packed audience here at the Albert Hall. Even the choir stalls are completely full, all but a couple of empty seats. And behind them, as I mentioned earlier, all of the 27 flags of the countries of the EU. And in the very centre of the back of the stage, the EU flag itself, which is right in front of the bust of Sir Henry Wood, the conductor, founder of the Proms, which has its place in front of the organ regularly every single season as a Proms tradition. It's a lovely mark of respect that you can hear from the orchestra. They are applauding Matthias Bammert, staying in their seats as he comes on stage, and are tapping their feet on the ground and their bows, certainly the string section on their stands, in appreciation of tonight's conductor. And now the orchestra on their feet, taking applause. They've got quite a packed schedule there in the middle of their summer tour. They're going back to Vienna next, then on to Łódź in Poland, then Amsterdam, Berlin, Switzerland, and then they're off to northern Italy, and we'll be off to Italy after the interval for Harold in Italy by Berlioz. So to get us in the mood while the audience here at the Albert Hall go off to have a drink, here on Radio 3 we're heading across the road to the Royal College of Music to the Proms Literary Festival. Matthew Sweet explores the inspiration behind Berlioz's music, the romantic hero of Byron's poem Childe Harold's Pilgrimage.
Welcome to the Proms Literary Festival, our summer-long series events here at the Royal College of Music, events that put words to the notes ringing out from the Albert Hall. Berlioz's Harold in Italy is on the conductor's lectern tonight, a four-movement symphony that, in a sense, already has words, because it wouldn't exist if Lord Byron hadn't written a four-canto poem called Childe Harold's Pilgrimage. It's a What I Did on My Holidays poem that changed the course of Byron's art and his life. I woke up one morning, he said, and found myself famous. We're going to follow Harold's journey, Byron's journey, and eventually take a view from the top. And let me tell you, we're in for quite a romantic evening because the actor Owen Teal is here to conjure Byron back to life, as are a pair of writers who have both been haunted by Byron's ghost. They are the historian and novelist Tom Holland, who's written on Byron's vampiric side, and the author Benjamin Markovitz, who's currently writing the last in a trilogy of books that have turned Byron's life into fiction, the bits that weren't fiction to begin with. Anyway, will you welcome them, please? Okay, so first let's discover something about this poem and how it was composed. Our Harold is a young man travelling round Europe. And it's a poem of two halves, isn't it, Tom, in terms of subject matter and the story of how it was written, too.
Yes, the first chunk is, as you said, it's sort of like a holiday diary. It's like a blog that he writes, but in Spenserian cantos. And the first two cantos describe his progress across the Mediterranean. And he writes this at the time of the Napoleonic Wars. So a huge chunk of Europe is off limits to him. So he goes to Spain, he goes to Portugal, he goes through the Mediterranean, then he goes to Greece and he goes to Turkey. Then he comes back, wakes up and finds himself famous, marries, it all goes disastrously wrong, and he sets off on his travels again. This time it's post-Waterloo. So he can't actually go to France for sort of complicated diplomatic reasons, but he cuts down along the Rhine into Switzerland and then into Italy. And the last two and the best two cantos describe that journey in 1816 and then through to 1818.
He actually wrote something else on his first tour as well. When he went to the continent for the first time, he was a gap year after university. And he had published two volumes of verse to that point. One was Hours of Idleness, which was a collection of lyrics, and got a mostly kind reception because he made a big deal about being a lord, so everyone had to be nice to him. But there were some stinging reviews as well. And in response to the stinging reviews, he wrote a poem called English Bards and Scotch Reviewers, which was actually the poem that made me like him for the first time when I was about 13 years old, because he spends a lot of time making fun of the critics who had made fun of him in very vibrant couplets, old-fashioned Augustan couplets. And when he went on his continental tour, he wrote another poem in the manner of English bards and Scotch reviewers called Hints from Horace, which he thought was the real star of his tour. This is what he had been laboring on. And he came back with that and the first two cantos of Childe Harold, and he tried to get Hints from Horace published. And in fact, Hints from Horace was never published in his lifetime. And Childe Harold's Pilgrimage made him famous. And he then was stuck with this fame because he'd written this not very good, best-selling poem about being a debauched young lord and had to follow it up with other Eastern tales until he could discover a way of bringing back Hints from Horace, which is what he learns to do in Italy.
I actually think that there are chunks of it that are remarkably good, actually, particularly the passages set in Greece, which at the time was ruled by under the Ottoman Empire. And there's this sense of the contrast between the greatness of classical antiquity and the ruin and despondency of current Greece. And it sets up this sort of a charge that is both classical and romantic. And this is a period that is absolutely steeped in admiration for the classics, but it's also a period in which people are very conscious of being hemmed in on their island. You know, the Napoleonic blockade is in operation. People simply cannot leave England without great difficulty. And so this is an immense splash of colour landing on the doorstep of the English reader. And I think that that is partly the reason.
Okay, well, I think it might be time to hear some of this work now. If there had been any such thing as an immigration card in 1812, this is what Byron would have put in the box marked Reason for Travelling. Owen Teal is going to read.
And now Childe Harold was sore sick at heart, and from his fellow bacchanals would flee. 'Tis said at times the sullen tear would start, but pride congealed the drop within his eye. Apart he stalked in joyless reverie, and from his native land resolved to go and visit scorching climes beyond the sea. With pleasure drugged, he almost longed for woe, and e'en for change of scene would seek the shades below.
Ben.
I think Tom is right that the first two cantos show a lot of interesting historical awareness, but I think that's not what people bought him for. And if you think of the history of literature as one that involves technological innovation, this is four stanzas into Childe Harold, and Byron has already laid out the classic Byronic hero, which had existed in some form before, but has become much more well-known since in James Dean and rock and roll. And here you have all the elements of the Byronic hero. You have someone who is sinful, and it's got to be a fun kind of sin. It's not somebody who embezzles funds or chops up pigeons in his spare time. It's somebody who drinks and has lots of sex. But it's not enough that he just be sinful. He has to be able to distinguish himself from his other revelers in some way, so he needs to be unhappy. And you have the unhappy, sinful man here. He's someone who's realized that there's a limit to the kind of pleasure you can get from the world. And then there's the third element, which is very crucial to Byron, that there's got to be something redeeming about this unhappiness. And in this case, you already see that what's redeeming is his ability to love, but the love has to be baffled so that the unhappiness continues. And these three elements are laid out five stanzas into Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, and the fact that he was enormously good-looking, the fact that he was a young lord and had cut a swathe through English society, meant that the autobiographical identification turned this into a bestseller.
How important was that autobiographical identification, Tom? Because he produces in the preface a bit of a disclaimer for that, doesn't he? Insists that Childe Harold is a fictitious personage.
Absolutely. He's toying with the audience's expectations. And of course, it's true. I mean, you could tell from the reading, it's tremendously hammy. There's absolutely a sort of an element of teenage posing about it. But I think also that there is a hint of a sort of profounder existential crisis there. There is this sense that Byron is a man who is after sensation, he's after experience. And that's true of Harold as well. And when Byron comes back, he explodes upon the London social scene. And he's chiefly, becomes famous, notorious even, for his love affairs, for the scandals that surround his name. And so this sense that he's writing about in Harold of someone who is relentlessly searching after new experience, new sensation, melds perfectly with people's sense of what Byron is up to. And rather than just being someone who sleeps around for the sake of it, it becomes a psychological and a philosophical statement, which is absolutely brilliant, of course. I mean, it's a fantastic way to get women into bed. And of course, everything that he writes, not only in Childe Harold, but in a succession of poems that follow Childe Harold, forever hinting at a dark secret, the mark of Cain, something that happened to Byron on his travels. And that only adds to the allure of his mystery.
So, Tom,
what is it that happened? Well, my personal theory, and I'm going out on a limb here, is that actually what happened in Greece is that what Byron found, and he is the first poet in English to write about it, was the myth of the vampire. And Byron writes this up, and it is thanks chiefly to Byron that it then passes into the bloodstream of British and Western literature. So the entire image of the vampire really derives from Byron. But in the passage that Byron writes, the very first passage in English literature, there is one aspect of the vampire myth which has not been picked up on, and that is the curse of being a vampire is that you are particularly drawn to the blood of those you are closest to, the blood of your own family. Now, what happens when Byron returns from Greece? Well, within a month, his mother is dead. He then embarks on a passionate affair with his sister. He marries, he has a daughter. The moment his daughter is born, he flees to the continent as though he is terrified to be in the presence of his own child. I could go on, but I think the evidence is stacking that clearly there was something in the blood of his near relatives that did indeed torment and terrify him.
Okay, well, let's hear a bit of that evidence. We're going to leave Childe Harold on a mountainside somewhere, wishing that he'd read the brigand section of The Lonely Planet a bit more thoroughly, and hear how he engaged with that myth that we've been discussing. Owen's going to read for us now from Giawa.
But thou, false infidel, shalt writhe beneath the avenging monkey's scythe, and from its torment scape alone to wander round lost Eblis' throne, and fire unquenched, unquenchable, around within thy heart shall dwell. Nor ear can hear, nor tongue can tell the tortures of that inward hell. But first, on earth as vampire sent, thy corse shall from its tomb be rent, then ghastly haunt thy native place, and suck the blood of all thy race. There from thy daughter, sister, wife, at midnight drain the stream of life, yet loathe the banquet which perforce must feed thy livid living course. Thy victims, ere they yet expire, shall know the demon for thy sire, as cursing thee, thou cursing them, thy flowers are withered on the stem. Wet with thine own best blood shall drip thy gnashing tooth and haggard lip. Then stalking to thy sullen grave, go and with ghouls and afrits rave, till these in horror shrink away from spectre more accursed than they.
Thank you very much, Owen Teal. How much does Byron really identify with this figure?
Although I don't think that Byron really was a vampire, when I had the idea of writing his life as a vampiric figure, I was reading through his diaries and I came across this passage. And I just read it. If I could explain at length, Byron is writing, he's talking about his memoirs, if I could explain at length the real causes which have contributed to increase this perhaps natural temperament of mine, this melancholy which hath made me a byword, nobody would wonder. But this is impossible without doing much mischief. I do not know what other men's lives have been, but I cannot conceive anything more strange than some of the earlier parts of mine. I've written my memoirs, but omitted all the really consequential and important parts, from deference to the dead, to the living, and to those who must be both. I rest my case. You can imagine.
Ben, are you going to speak for the prosecution or the defense here?
What's interesting about the vampire story from Byron's point of view is also what's interesting about it from our point of view, and accounts in large part for the success, say, of the Twilight series. What's the essence of the vampire story? That you are sexually attracted to someone that you destroy. This is sort of the heart of it. This is why we continue to read it, because as a metaphor, it seems very powerful to us in lots of ways that aren't vampiric. And then you think, well, why would Byron find that so evocative a metaphor? Who was he attracted to that his love destroyed? And this was the theme that haunts his letters, that he kept on destroying the things that he loved. Well, there are two answers to that. The one answer is that he was attracted to his half-sister, Augusta, with whom he began an affair after he became a lion in London. which isn't quite as kinky as it sounds. She was his half-sister. He didn't know her as a kid. But still, they were conscious of wrongdoing, and he was conscious that his love for her, his sexual love for her, was destroying her life, and she ends up a very pitiful figure. And the other kind of love, which was destructive, was his love of men or of boys. And one account for the reason he had to flee the country after his undergraduate years is that he had become impossibly close to a choir boy in Cambridge named Eddleston, and that if he stayed any longer, something would have happened. Of course, when he gets to the continent, lots of things happen. And this is one of the reasons that his friend Hobhouse, who was a little disgusted with him, left their travels earlier.
Tom, whether or not we should be reading Byron with garlic wrapped around our necks or not, he's certainly responsible for an idea that's still very live in the culture, the idea of the doomed hero.
Absolutely, and he projects it on an almost Napoleonic scale. You know, this is the era of Bonaparte, it is the era of Beethoven, it is the period in which great figures seize their destiny and then are doomed by it. And Byron is the poetic expression of that. And it is worth emphasizing the sheer degree of his fame. I mean, Childe Harold is probably the best-selling poem of all time. And Byron ends up a figure of international reputation. Aside from Bonaparte, he becomes quite simply the most famous man on the planet. And the impact of this, not just on literature, but on European culture generally, is completely seismic.
Okay, well, let's return to Childe Harold and to the part of the poem by which Berlioz was inspired.
I see before me the gladiator lie. He leans upon his hand, his manly brow, consents to death, but conquers agony, and his drooped head sinks gradually low, and through his side the last drops, ebbing slow, from the red gash fall heavy one by one, like the first of a thunder shower. And now the arena swims around him. He is gone. Ere ceased the inhuman shout which hailed the wretch who won. He heard it, but he heeded not. His eyes were with his heart, and that was far away. He recked not of the life he lost, nor prize, but where his rude hut by the Danube lay. There were his young barbarians all at play. There was their Dacian mother, he, their sire, butchered to make a Roman holiday. All this rushed with his blood. Shall he expire, an unavenged? Arise, ye Goths, and glut your ire.
I mean, speak on a personal level, I cannot begin to tell you the impact that had on me when I was 16, a sort of romantic enthusiast for ancient Rome. To read that was absolutely knockout stuff. The dying gladiator is actually the statue that is now known as the Dying Gaul. But it's used so powerfully, both to look backwards. Byron is imagining these cycles of great empires that rise and fall. And the poem ends, actually, with an astounding vision of the immensity of the ocean into which all of human civilization ultimately will collapse and become as nothing. And what you have is this sense of the poet alone in a world in which the world of the present has become one with the lost and abandoned civilizations of the past.
And where do these themes take him, Ben? Where does the improvement that you've identified in Childe Harold, where is that legible in his later work?
Well, the idea behind the Byronic hero seems to be that the problem with life is that people don't get over things. So the Byronic hero, Childe Harold, is constantly haunted by this sense of loss, of sin, that he can never escape, and that defines his entire existence. And the idea behind the later Byron is that what's tragic about life is that people do get over things. And this eventually leads him, not in Harold itself, which is a more mature poem, but still Byronic in the old way, to Beppo, which is the story of a woman whose husband is believed dead, and after 2 or 3 years of mourning him, she takes to herself a lover, as Italian women did at the time, only to discover a number of years after that that a Turkish-looking man at a market has approached her claiming to be her dead husband. And eventually they all get on very well. Nothing is tragic. The fact that there are three lovers in this marriage doesn't bother anyone. And what's the odd, sad note at the end of it is, if this is love, why is it worth so much? And this is what Byron moves to in the end.
Okay, well, let's try and assess where Byron has been going on this journey from Childe Harold to Beppo. If this is a sort of pilgrimage, you know, what has he been seeking?
Well, ultimately, Byron really does become a hero because finally he chucks all that in and goes off to fight and ultimately die for the cause of freedom in Greece. He dies rather ingloriously of illness. He never actually gets to grips with the Turks. But that sort of doesn't matter because his myth is established. And really, I guess the goal of his pilgrimage lies in his death, which is at once gloriously heroic and self-cuttingly embarrassing at the same time.
There's a kind of chicken and egg argument among Byron readers and Byron critics, which is more important, the sentiment or the irony. And there are postmodernists who want to rescue Byron as someone who sends up romantic tropes. I don't think they're right about him. I think the sentiment is important. And what he learns in the course of his career, that in order to earn the sentiment, you have to begin with irony. But the note he usually ends on is this, the old tender, loving one that he had been playing from the beginning.
I think it is terribly important that he dies when he does. He's 36. And his very last poem, he laments the fact that he is passing into a sort of decrepit middle age, with which I can profoundly relate now. So he's a poet for your entire life. But I think the fact that Byron dies and doesn't, like Coleridge or Wordsworth, grow old, turn Tory, become a reactionary, is terribly important to his posthumous reputation, as of course it is with Keats and Shelley as well, who also die young.
And there our travel permit expires. It's time to send our guests on their way. Tom Holland, Benjamin Markovitz, and Owen Teal. Thank you all.
For that edition of the Proms Literary Festival, Matthew Sweet was joined by Benjamin Markovitz and Tom Holland, and the reader was Owen Teal. The programme was produced by Allegra McIlroy. Well, welcome back this evening to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of two proms tonight at the BBC Proms, the World Roots Academy, later on this evening. But now we're in the company of the EUIO, the European Union Youth Orchestra, conducted tonight at the Proms by Matthias Bamert. And the final piece, just one after the interval in this prom, is by Berlioz, Harold in Italy. At the beginning of the 1830s, Berlioz won the coveted Prix de Rome, a musical prize, and he went off for his prize to Italy. Interestingly, it was Italy itself and not Italian music making that really excited Berlioz once he was there. He found Italian opera and the music in general in the country pretty boring, but the landscape delighted him. He wrote of his longing to go to Calabria or to Capri and, I'm quoting, "put myself in the service of a brigand chief. That's the life I crave. Volcanoes, rocks, rich piles of plunder in mountain caves, pistols, blood, a bed of lava rocked by subterranean tremors." Pretty dramatic stuff, some of which made its way into the four musical postcards that make up his symphonic response to his Italian travels, Harold in Italy. And the Harold he refers to is the Childe Harold, Byron's hero, whom we've just heard about in that interval feature. Well, once back in Paris, it was actually Paganini who commissioned Berlioz to write a piece to show off a Stradivarius viola he'd just got his hands on. And the result was this four-part symphony with solo viola. But as tonight's soloist Maxim Rizanov explained to me earlier on today, Paganini wasn't best pleased.
Paganini's big problem was that he was crazy and he wanted his music to look black because it would have so many fast passages and double stops. But Berlioz's idea was to actually write a symphony where viola would be, let's say, solo soprano. Paganini actually said when he saw the music that he didn't want to play it anymore. Just sort of was upset that Berlioz thought of him as such a poor player. He still came to the premiere and someone else played it, and apparently he came up to Berlioz and kissed his hand.
And how is it for you playing with these young musicians?
I think they're fantastic. I think they're great, and I've never been a part of the EU orchestra because I come from Ukraine, and at the time I was already at the Guildhall, I was still holding the Ukrainian passport, so I could never get into anything like that. For me, it's a payback now that I've been just now for a few days with them in Austria and here in London, because they're just a mad, crazy young orchestra who play with such energy and great quality, and it's just been really a lot of fun so far.
Tonight's soloist, Maxim Rezanov. Hushed silence here in the Royal Albert Hall as we wait for him to come onto the stage. We'll be hearing Berlioz's Harold in Italy, which is in four parts, starting with Harold in the Mountains, then the March of Pilgrims singing the evening prayer, then the Abruzzi Highlander serenade to his mistress, music which, when heard it in real time, Berlioz said was frankly very irritating, and then the Brigand's orgy and recollection of earlier scenes. Berlioz's Harold in Italy, performed for us here at the Proms by Maxim Rezanov and the EUIO, conducted by Matthias Bamert.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Radio 3 new generation artist Maxim Rizanov, the viola soloist with the European Union Youth Orchestra, conducted by Matthias Bamert in music by Berlioz. Harold in Italy. It's amazing what inspiration can come from a bad night's sleep. Apparently one night while he was in Italy, where he was travelling, thanks to having won the Prix de Rome, Berlioz was kept up all night by young men serenading their lovers under their windows. And that racket he turned into the inspiration for the final two movements of Harold in Italy. That stamping you can hear is from the members of the EUIO, who are very keen to see young Maxim Rizanov return to the stage of the Royal Albert Hall. Wild applause both from the orchestra and from the packed audience here for this soloist who will be returning to the Proms for the last night. He's going to be playing his own arrangement of Tchaikovsky's Rococo Variations, originally a piece for solo cello and orchestra, his own arrangement, of course, for his instrument, the viola. The EUIO are going to be ending their tour, which they're just at the start of at the moment, where Berlioz began his, in northern Italy. And their conductor tonight, Matthias Bamert, returning to the stage. This is his 19th appearance at the Proms, by all accounts. He and I were having a chat about numbers earlier on. If you want to know the exact number of times he's been here, you can, of course, go online to the Proms website and do your own search on the archive. Just search by artist. That's bbc.co.uk/proms and click on the links to the archive. Matthias Bamert, in his very precise way, pointing to each member of the woodwind section, all of the principals, to take a bow here at the Proms. Well, tomorrow night you can hear Ingo Metzmacher and the Deutsche Symphony Orchestra of Berlin playing Mahler 7, and Leonidas Kavakos joins them for the Korngold Violin Concerto. But the music making isn't over tonight here at the Royal Albert Hall. At 10 o'clock, that's in just under an hour, the late night prom tonight is given by Radio 3's World Roots Academy. The Iraqi guitarist Ilham Al-Madafi has been mentoring the young London-based oud player Ghayam Alami, and they're going to take centre stage together. I was at their rehearsal earlier on today, and you're in for a real treat. Don't miss it. So stay with us here on Radio 3. And for the next hour, I hand you on to John Shea in Broadcasting House.
Sarah, thank you very much. That was Sarah Moore-Peach presenting the first of tonight's two proms from the Royal Albert Hall. There's another chance to hear that concert on Wednesday week. That's at 2 o'clock in the afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. Or, of course, any time you like before then by using the Listen Again facility on the Radio 3 website. And if you are going online to have a look at the Proms archive, as Sarah just suggested, well, there's something else that you can do on the Proms website, and that's to submit your own review of tonight's concert, or indeed any others. bbc.co.uk/proms, and then click on Share. Well, as Sarah just said, we're back at the Royal Albert Hall at 10 o'clock tonight for the second of tonight's proms. In the meantime, the conductor, Sir Roger Norrington, is in conversation with Norman Lebrecht. That's coming up in just a minute. Before it, though, a look ahead to Sunday night's Drama on Three.
Drama on Three, The White Devil.
Bracciano now lives in Rome, and by close panderism seeks to prostitute the honour of Vittoria Corombona.
John Webster's revenge tragedy, first performed in 1612, now set in a murky underworld of the 1950s.
Who lodged beneath your roof that fatal night your husband broke his neck?
I was there.
Your business, Bracciano?
Why, I came to comfort her.
A passion so strong it drives a man to murder, and in doing so conjures up a deadly enemy.
Bracciano, I am now fit for thy encounter. I'll ne'er think thee dead till I can play at football with thy head.
Classic drama, The White Devil, this Sunday night at 8:45 here on BBC Radio 3.
So we've music from Iraq in our late night prom in just under an hour from now, 10 o'clock. That's presented by Lucy Duran. Now, though, with the time at 9:04 here on BBC Radio 3, we come to the Lebrecht interview. Here's Norman Lebrecht.
Roger Norrington has been a mover and shaker in music for almost half a century. And when I say shaker, I don't mean using vibrato, which is one of his pet hates. He founded the Schütz Choir and the London Classical Players and was music director of Kent Opera before taking his place with great orchestras in Europe and America. Lately, he's been conducting Mahler in a style that some find contentious, others revealing. The son of an Oxford vice-chancellor, Norrington was put to work in academic publishing before the musical imperative took over. His approach differed from other period leaders in concentrating less on old instruments and more on the texture of sound. He has outlasted many of his noisier contemporaries, a triumph the more remarkable since two decades ago he developed a brain tumour and was given just months to live. At 76, he looks the picture of contentment when we meet in the summer house of his rambling Victorian mansion where he lives with his wife Kay Lawrence in Berkshire. Roger Norrington, what's your first waking thought?
Is there a concert today? I should think. Lots of different thoughts, but that's certainly one. Is this a day I have to deliver stuff, or can I just relax like today?
Was there a routine from childhood when you got up in the morning? Were you taught to pray? Were there duties that you had to face?
No, I don't think so. The household had breakfast at 8. And I remember we always listened to the news because it was wartime. So there'd be very, very loud one wireless in the house, as it was in those days, playing loudly where we got to after D-Day so that we could all hear it. We had a map on the wall with a sort of red line of wool which showed the current front line. I mean, that was the sort of world one lived in those days.
That was in your early teens?
In the 40s, yes.
Your father, Sir Arthur Norrington, presided over a very high table. He was the vice-chancellor who invented the Norrington League that still ranks merit among the different Oxford colleges. Was he a great Oxford grandee?
No, I mean, he wasn't a grand person, but he was very useful. I mean, he'd been president of Trinity for some years, and of course in those days the vice-chancellor simply went round the senior head of the house. A number of people died in front of him, so to speak, so he made it to vice-chancellor earlier than he would normally have done. But he was very useful at it because he was good at business and stuff. But no, he wasn't very grand at all, thank goodness. We none of us tried to be grand.
And on the intellectual side?
Well, he was very, very clever, double first in classics at Oxford, and he'd been a Winchester scholar. So he was one of those boys, you know, came from nowhere really, but just had a very good brain.
Mm. Challenging for you as a child? My father's so brilliant?
No, because he was very straightforward and jolly and witty and nice. And no, he wasn't grand in that sense either. I mean, he wasn't sort of awe-inspiring. Mm. I just knew he was much cleverer than I was, but then so were my sisters, for instance, cleverer than I. So I was used to other people being cleverer.
What did you do together, you and your parents?
Well, we walked in the Welsh mountains on our holidays. That was where we always went, walking all day, you know, in the rain often enough, or in the Lake District, reading Wordsworth. Six of us, and sometimes friends as well, in a big hired house in the Welsh hills. We took copies of Shakespeare with us and read plays within the family. No TV, no radio, oil lamps. So it was rather rustic. My mother always played the male lead. That's very symbolic, isn't it? She was always Henry V, you know. I remember that quite clearly. She was very keen on acting as a child.
What do you remember of Oxford before the war?
I don't really remember it before the war because we were sent to Canada in 1940.
You and your sisters?
Yeah, four children, my brother as well.
Right.
So I don't really remember. I don't remember Oxford before.
Do you remember the discussions about being sent there?
Yes.
Should we send them? Should we?
Yes,
keep?
But I mean, what? Of course, I didn't take part in those. I was six. I mean,
right.
You just did what you were told. So it was a mad idea, but at the time, I suppose it seemed sensible. It was free. It was offered by the university. Free passage to Canada.
For the sons of vice-chancellors?
Well, people in the university at all. I mean, he wasn't vice-chancellor then, of course. But I suppose they thought, you know, it isn't a question of if there'll be an invasion. It's a question of when. And I suppose they thought, here's a chance. We're being offered free accommodation just for a few months. So I don't remember Oxford until 44 when I
But
came
you remember
back.
The journey early in the war?
Yes, I remember the journey out. Mm. Yeah, terrifying. and the journey back on a warship. I came back.
Why terrifying?
Well, weather, zigzagging across because we were alone, and then hitting something or something hitting us off Canada, either a mine or a torpedo. It didn't sink us, but it jolly nearly did. And that boat came back from Canada with the next lot of women and children on board, went to the bottom. After that, I think they stopped this funny business of sending people across.
Did that change you, those years in Canada, those years away from
home? Of course, yeah, no dad, being a foreigner, picking up an accent in 2 weeks, a Canadian accent. So I was bilingual in Canadian and English. I could speak to my mum in English and say, yeah, come on, guys. I was sort of dual personality. But it was good for learning languages later because you got an ear for sound.
And when you came back, middle of the war, and went to school, was there a stigma attached because of your absence?
Oh, it was really weird trying to be English, yeah. I mean, cricket, I had no idea what cricket was. I knew about ice hockey and baseball. And they were so prim, the boys. They were so sort of, yes, rather, yes, yes, sir. I mean, it was very, I find it very difficult to fit in. I didn't fit in for several years. Perhaps I never did. But that can give you a kind of objectivity to life. It sets you apart a bit, and sometimes that can be useful when you're in the arts. You know, it gives you a standpoint. I don't know.
And was that, do you feel, your own separateness, or was there also, did you feel a rejection on the part of those who'd been here through the Blitz, and you were coming in when the show had turned?
Yes, good point. Yes, I don't recall, you know. Yes, we had bananas during the war, for instance, yes. I don't recall that sort of envy, really, from other people. It was just, they were so different. And they all knew things that I didn't know, like Latin and Greek and stuff. So I was kind of disadvantaged by it. But, you know, that's life, isn't it?
Were you good at school? Did you get through?
No, I wasn't very good at school, no. I was just average to not very good, nor at university, indeed. I mean, I wasn't brilliant at all, but I kept learning things and enjoying them. And in the end, you know, that's what matters. It isn't the final mark, unless you want to be in the civil service.
And you did national service in the RAF.
Yes.
Trying to stop planes crashing at Bournemouth, where not many do. You were a flight controller.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I did a bit of flying as well, which is quite fun. Now, 2 years in the Air Force was very good for me, I think, like getting out of school and, you know, being with all sorts of different kinds of people. It was good after a privileged background, and I think it was also quite fun. And I began to, you know, pull my weight and be useful. So it was good to do that before university.
I mean, did it accentuate your separateness?
Oh, I don't know. I certainly, they thought I was pretty strange, practising the violin in the officer's mess and singing. And they thought that was extremely peculiar. So I suppose I was pretty separate, yeah.
And then you did a lot more of that at college?
At Cambridge. Lots of music all the time, although I wasn't reading music, I was reading English, which I enjoyed a lot, but wasn't particularly good at either. But I was getting quite good at music.
And you were then put to work in academic publishing?
I wasn't put to work. But, yeah, I really thought it would be nice to go on doing, you know, things to do with books because I enjoyed them, and I couldn't really think of anything else I wanted to do. So I did it. And did music every evening of the week and every weekend and every holidays, but entirely without planning to be a professional, just as an amateur.
So you have this very nice life-work balance, where work is handling other people's manuscripts, and life is making music in the evenings, singing, playing, conducting a bit. When did you start to think you could do this? I mean, did you think, watching other conductors, oh, I could do this, or did you think, I could actually be quite good at this?
Well, I'd already, even at Cambridge, I mean, I knew that I was quite good at it, in an amateur sort of way, because people liked it and said, what can we do next, that kind of thing. You know, there's a natural response.
You get a bunch of people together.
Yeah, I get a bunch of people together, and they would say, well, that was marvellous, what can we do next? And you thought, oh, well, that's nice. So I knew I was quite good at it as an amateur level, but it never crossed my mind for many years, till I was maybe 26, that I could possibly make a living at it. I didn't know about how you did that, you know. It's like joining a circus or something. I mean, how do you feed elephants and... do I have to do the high wire before I do the tigers? I mean, I hadn't any idea how you could be a musician. So I didn't think I could. So I sort of put it off. And then when I was 28, it sort of finally, the penny dropped. And also I'd got good enough, I suppose.
And what was the trigger? What showed you how to get into the circus?
Well, I began to be asked to sing professionally in small groups and to play professionally in small groups. People assumed I was a professional, I suppose.
What kind of
and
voice?
Then I started
what kind of voice?
Tenor. Mm-hmm. So I moved from treble to tenor. So I had a life as a treble, then life as a tenor and a violin. And then I started the Schutz Choir of London in 1962. Mm. And, you know, doing that concert showed me that there was some kind of a future, I suppose. And it was suddenly incredibly well reviewed and a lot of interest taken. And I thought, oh, goodness. I mean, we kind of wandered on from there in an amateurish kind of way. But I was sent to Africa by the press.
And that's Oxford University Press.
Yeah, and then I had lots of time to sort of think. You know, and I'd just been...
Where were you in Africa?
At Nairobi, and the whole of the East. Mm-hmm. And I was in charge. I mean, there was one man, you know, it was me. Just for 6 months or even less, or somebody, while somebody was away. Yeah. So I had all this time and space and no rehearsals and no singing to do. And I just played the fiddle on my own. But it gave me a lot of time to think, now, what are you going to do? What are you going to do about this? It was a very difficult and painful discussion with myself at 28. You know, it's too late. Everybody's 10 years ahead of you. You aren't good enough, etc., etc. And then on my way back from Africa, in Greece, I stopped off in various places using the airfare, so to speak. I sort of made the decision one evening, coming back from Epidavros at dusk in a minibus. I said, yep, I'm going to go home and resign and be a musician, come what may. And so I did. It was extremely scary, but luckily I wasn't married, or you know, I hadn't got any dependents, and so I could gradually sell, you know, my camera and my car and my if I had to. I worked out a sort of plan, and I just went back and started looking for work. Luckily I had this excellently trained voice, because I'd been taking it seriously for 10 years, I suppose, and having lessons, and tenor voices don't settle till you're about 28. So thinking about it, you know, suddenly I had something to offer, so I could just turn up and audition and get all sorts of stuff. I was a contemporary of John Shirley Quirk and Robert Tyr and Neil Howlett and people like that, nearly of Janet Baker. So we were all doing stuff together in various ways, and so it seemed a possibility. Or a Philip Langridge, actually, who just died, great friend. We were together in many choirs. And Aldborough and in London and so on. So I could have been Philip Langridge. A very similar sort of voice. Expressive, a little bit hard, but very strong personality. Yeah. I thought, well, I'll do that. Anyway, I can make my living as a singer, so I did for about 5 or 6 years.
And by that time you were already at the Royal College?
Yes, I went. I don't know anything about music, so I'd better get some legitimacy. Also, I could get a grant from the LCC, London County Council, which helped, you know, it was a huge amount of money, £50 or something like that. I mean, really useful stuff. So I went to college, and, yeah, they very kindly took me in. And I went for 1 year, and then I got another year, and then I left.
And you studied with Sir Adrian Bolt?
Yes, I did. Yes.
What did you learn from
conducting Bolt? With Adrian Bolt and keyboard with somebody else.
Terribly, terribly traditional world that you stepped into. I mean, this is the 1960s, the Royal College, in the Royal College of Music, it's about 1910.
Yes, absolutely. And he was about 1910. But, I mean, in other ways, it was livelier. Of course, it's much livelier now. And there were things you could learn, even from somebody like Adrian, who was very staid and very grand in a way. But, I mean, lots of musicians loved working for him, you know. He did some very fine things. He wasn't at all my kind of conductor, but I learned stuff from him, you know, within the class. It's all I ever did learn. The rest I taught myself, you know. I mean, so many of us are self-taught, really.
Did he do anything for you that was supportive in any way?
No, I don't think so. He did, like offering me a job with the LPO or something. Yeah. No, I don't think he had really much to offer in that way. Mm. He just said, come to rehearsals whenever you like or whatever I'm doing. But it was fine. It was useful, and I did other things there, and tried.
You were watching other conductors who mattered more to you.
All
watching
the time,
Colin Davis and Sanders Wells.
I'd worked with Colin at Chelsea Opera Group, and yes, I saw him at Sanders Wells, and I saw Beecham, and so on. I went to a lot of concerts, and learned a lot from people. And then people like Giulini, you know, a little later on. I mean, he was marvellous. Mm. I learned a lot from him. Not a lot from Klemperer, who I also sang under. Rather minimalist. But, I mean, one learned things all the time. Yeah, all the time from watching people, often learning more from people who one shouldn't be learning from. I mean, you'll learn things not to do as much as what to do, funnily enough. Because if someone's as brilliant as Giulini or Carlos Klaber, you know, you can't quite identify how in the hell they're doing it. You know, whereas if somebody does something badly, you think, ah, don't do that. You know, that's a really bad idea, you know. So actually, you can learn from people's mistakes just as much as from their brilliance. Right. Their brilliance terrifies you.
Yeah. Yes. No, I get more from bad concerts than from routine performances.
In a way.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. The other end of the scale, I was at Cambridge last week with Cumbs, with the Music Society, doing a concert in King's Chapel. What a marvellous place. And some of the young conductors came up, you know, afterwards and said, how long did it take you to develop a technique which just seems to work effortlessly with no, you're not really doing anything much, are you? And yet it worked. How long did it take you? I said, about 40 years. So the tide turns and people try and learn things from you.
And all around you, while you're at the college, end of the 60s, there's this literally grassroots revolution going on, and people are making music in open-toed sandals and with fragrance of substances, and they're doing it, they think, in the way that Bach intended. And there's David Munro, who's functioning as a kind of catalyst for everything that's going
on,
and Hogwood, and showing that music didn't have to be all pomp and circumstance. Yeah, how did you get involved there?
Well, I suppose by having a Schütz choir already from 62, I was already a player in that game, and, well, at least I could be, but in point of fact, to begin with, I was using, you know, a choir with tons of vibrato, which I thought was the very thing, miles bigger than it would have been in Schütz's day, I mean, sort of 30, 40 people, so it was completely unhistorical. But that music led one to the things in the score, saying there's a chitarrone or a trombone and so on, and you think, oh, well, what are those instruments? So gradually, the first time you do something, you might do it with modern brass, and the next time you think, well, maybe we could do this with cornetti and cornettini and sackbuts. And so it was simply around, and it interested me at once, having always been interested in earlier music, I mean, Byrd and Palestrina and so on before, and having read history before I read English. At school, I was a specialist in history, so I had a historical viewpoint. And indeed, English literature is also a historical viewpoint, so that it was natural to, when I took a piece of music, it was natural for me to say, now, what does that mean to the people of 1760, or 1455, for that matter? But of course, no one does that in a music college. They say, this is how it goes, young man, do it like this. And of course, I would always be saying, why? Does a fermata always mean, you know, a pause? Because it doesn't, it means lots of other things. But those questions were not asked in the old conservatoires. You know, very few people had a sort of scholarly interest in history, really. History was bunk, I think, like Henry Ford famously said.
Was it a competitive scene, the early music thing? Did you feel you and Hogwood and Munro and Trevor Pinnett that you were up against each other?
I suppose so, but I mean,
John Elliott Gardner later on.
Yeah, he was one of, he sang in my choir.
Any good?
There were competitive areas, but mostly I was the foolish one who went ahead, you know, into the wilderness. If everyone was doing Bach and Handel, I'd be trying Haydn. And then when they were doing Haydn, I'd be doing Beethoven. Because I was just always interested to know what happened next. And in a way, I wanted to have that chance of finding out before somebody else told me, if you see what I mean. I mean, if you've never played Beethoven as he said he wanted it played, on the instruments he expected, then it's incredibly frightening, but incredibly creative. And I was happy to be first and take the risk of a disaster, because it was just prodigiously exciting for year after year after year.
And then you take this sideways step into Kent Opera. Mm. Some early music, but also contemporary and everything else.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm interested in any kind of music that's marvellous. All the time I was doing, you know, Schütz from the 60s, I was perfectly happy to be, you know, doing Tchaikovsky and Dvorak and that as well. I mean, it wasn't a total specialisation at all. So I wasn't also an innocent, suddenly turned loose on Rigoletto, so to speak. There was a very wide spectrum of interest. How did I get into it, did you think? Another Norman Platt.
Norman Platt.
Norman Platt. He invented Kent Opera. I didn't start it. But I was the first conductor, and for 15 years or something, the only conductor, actually, of Kent Opera. So we did
500 performances.
Something like that, yeah.
47 operas.
Well, you're very well informed, yes, if you say so. Yeah, I mean, we did quite a lot of early things. I mean, we did all the Monteverdi operas.
All the Monteverdis. Which was a huge breakthrough.
That was key. I mean, yes, that was, you know, with the original instruments and with original pitches. So Poppea, you know, Nero was a soprano as well, you know, which was the first time it'd ever been done. I think I also did, in the Elsie Opera Group, Idomeneo with a mezzo Idamante, the first time it had ever been done. Young singer straight out of college. I think her name was Kirite Kanawa. Unheard since. So that was a very, very early, early part of hers. We put her in a trouser suit, up-to-date trouser suit. To put a woman on stage in trousers was a big event. But I was very keen on that kind of thing, you know, if it's written for a mezzo, you don't give it to a tenor. And having the two sopranos in Poppea, to hear those two soprano voices intertwining in the last duet was incredibly exciting. So there was always pay gold from the little bits of semi-scholarly work that one did.
But you were very hands-on as music director. You were picking the directors, directors.
Well, with Norman, actually. But I mean, yeah,
well,
I mean,
Jonathan Miller never lets anyone forget that you were responsible for making him an opera director.
Yeah, well, we had a wonderful time. I mean, I think it was seven operas we did, and ranging from Orfeo of Monteverdi to Traviata and Fidelio. I mean, he was a marvellous influence and a wonderful, wonderful colleague in those days, and he certainly looks back to it with nostalgia, as I do in a way, because, you know, working in big houses is exciting, but it's never quite the same as it was working in Kent Opera, where you were kind of making it up as you went along, and there was something extraordinarily good about it.
There was a huge outcry when Kent Opera lost its Arts Council subsidy and was effectively abolished during the financial stringency of the early 1980s, which is a time not that different from what we're about to face today. The reason given was that there was no need for Kent Opera. Anyone in Kent could hop on a train to London and see anything they wanted there. Was Kent Opera really necessary? When one makes those choices, can you justify it as a businessman?
Well, of course, I was gone by then, so I didn't have any part in it. But nothing is necessary. No art is necessary. You didn't need Glyndebourne either. You could pop up the road, but people instead popped down the road in evening dress in 1934 to hear Figaro. So, I mean, it's as necessary as it is good, I suppose. And I must say that when it was at its best, while I was there, anyone would say, of course it's worth it. And if it starts slipping from that pedestal, I don't know what happened, I only saw one or two things afterwards, then it becomes unnecessary. And there were other politics involved, no doubt. I really don't know the exact details. But all these things are only as necessary as they are good. I mean, the London Symphony Orchestra or Covent Garden or whatever, some things just go on because they've got momentum. And several times, of course, I've pulled the plug on groups because I didn't want to just go on being the same forever. For their own sake.
That's right, you shut down the Schütz Choir, you merged London Classical Players with Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. Right. You're pretty good at closing down.
Yeah, I've closed down practically everything. One was Sinfonietta closed down after I left. But in a way, I think that's fine. You know, something springs up, it's exciting, it sees the light of day for its own reasons, and it doesn't need to keep going forever just because it's there. It's very hard to keep some of these organisations going.
Was there a lesson that you took away from this, that as a self-starter, that you're probably better off without state patronage? You're better off running your own show and deciding when to open, when to close?
No. I mean, I've absolutely loved the last 10 years when I've been paid by the state, the German state, the German taxpayer. There, suddenly, I was part of a big organisation which is virtually permanent. And I find it absolutely fine. No, I think you can do things anyway, unless the conditions just aren't good enough. The people around you are so boring, or whatever it is. I don't think it has to be the fight of the little wren against the eagle. I've just got used to being self-employed, really, you know, and just doing things around. I've always have been. I mean, even this German job I have now, it's only, you know, for a certain number of weeks a year. So I'm still living at risk, in a way.
It was a tremendous time for recording, 70s, the 80s. And then pretty much anything that you were doing on EMI, Christopher Hogwood was doing on Decca, and John Elliott Gardner was doing on Philips, and you were doing it in cycles, Beethoven, Mozart, Haydn, in your case, Schubert.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember watching you at Abbey Road, because I would drop in there to sessions, and what impressed me was how you would pop out behind the glass panel at the end of a movement, and you would bring several players out with you for the playback, and then get into quite heated discussion with them and with the producer and with the sound engineers as to how exactly it should go and whether what you'd just done was completely worthless.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there were 20, 30, 40 people in the box from the orchestra, all the people who were interested. Mm. And in a way, it was a collective, you know, somebody has to conduct an orchestra, but this orchestra was full of people who knew a huge amount about early instruments and about playing them. And I never pretended to know more than they do. In fact, I don't now with any orchestra. It's a collegial thing. Somebody has to lead it, but I mean, they have to play the notes and they have to believe in what they're doing. So it's great when we're all on the same side, you know. I just invite people to do things. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Hmm. Yours was never the loudest voice. This was very confusing for the suits and ties at EMI.
Yes. Well, in the end it was, though, you see, because when you listen to the performances, then... One good thing we did there was every take I did as a performance, I never was listening for mistakes. So I was the positive guy, and then it was usually David Murray. Later Simon Woods. He would be the bad guy. I'd let him speak direct to the orchestra, you know.
He was the producer.
None of this phone business, you know. The producer says the piccolo's a little sharp here. I mean, that's useless. You want to hear exactly what the producer has. So he spoke direct to the orchestra. And he would say, this is terrible, Alistair. And I would say, no, that was great. You know, I'd go absolutely, totally positive. So that the result is you get a sense of performance from, I think, from those recordings, which is quite useful. That was a very good way to work, I thought. You gave a producer a lot of responsibility, but then that's good. And it gave the players a lot of responsibility as well. So, yeah.
And you were trying to break down some of the conventions in the concert hall as well. You were holding open rehearsals.
Yes.
And you were inviting the audience to sing along in Beethoven 9.
Well, not in the concert, actually. Yeah, sort of...
Was that revolutionary spirit, or was it a sort of showmanship?
Yeah, both. Both. I mean, the main thing was that we were doing these projects, you know, we would do Beethoven 9. OK, no one had done it before. No one thought about what Beethoven wanted, as far as I can see, since, I don't know when, 1815. So we did a lot of research. The players and I, and I'd look for the best-known Beethoven scholars and just ring them up. And they were full of information, of course, and no one had ever asked them, you know, no one from the kitchen had ever asked them. So they were delighted. It was very easy to get answers. And we did a lot of work, a lot of research. And then you come to the concert and you play the music, and I thought, the audience is missing all the research. They don't understand why we're playing like that. They may or may not like it, but why don't we share the whole process with them? So the open rehearsal would explain, you know, the choices. What did he mean by that tempo? Could it possibly be the same as that tempo? And how many players there should be, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes I even ask the audience for a vote on a tempo or which is the better accompaniment, you know, a harpsichord or an organ. And I'd say, well, what do you think? And they would vote, some, then we'd do it in the concert. I mean, we made the audience...
Very good, that's interactive. It's a long way ahead of your time.
Yeah, we made the audience part of the crew. Mm-hmm. You know, you pull this rope, if you drop it, the sail's going to come down, you know. And so, yeah, people absolutely loved it. And they still do. And somebody said in New York Times a year or so ago, somebody a bit like you, you know, somebody with strong opinions, they said, the public love it when musicians talk to the audience. He said, the critics don't like it, but tough shit, music needs it. You know? I thought, yeah, absolutely right, music needs it. So that was, it was very challenging and very satisfying.
The early music revolution, like most revolutions, started out as being very open, all about freedom and equality and democracy, and wound up like all other revolutions as petty autocracies.
As dogma.
Yes. Well, as dogma and as little empires.
Little empires. Yes.
And it seemed to me that you perhaps were the one who preserved the original democracy, both in the way you made music and the way that you related to musicians and
all. Well, I would certainly like to think so. And of course,
I let it go.
I let them go. I mean, the choir and the orchestra. Mm. I didn't want to run an empire. No, not at all. That was a conscious decision, yeah. And when we made a lot of money on the Beethoven symphonies too, I didn't put it in my pocket, I gave it to the players, actually. I shared it out. We gave some to every single player who'd taken part, according to how many sessions they'd done. That surprised a good many people. But it just seemed to me, you know, you don't have to be a robber baron to be a musician. You need them, they need you. It's a marvellous sharing thing.
Did you ever, especially when you were shutting down enterprises or merging enterprises, did you ever step back and look at yourself and say, well, actually, what has been the sum of my achievements?
Not often.
In relation to others, perhaps?
No.
What was my unique selling point?
Oh, no, I don't think so, no. No, I mean, I just carry on and do the next thing. I mean, what's been so amazing is always having something new to do, you know. You start with a choir that's singing music nobody knows, and you go on to creating opera in a completely different way within small companies and small houses, as it used to be in the 18th and 19th century. And then you start an orchestra with original instruments where you're playing pieces which people thought they knew and they sound quite different. These tremendous projects, and then a project like the Experience Weekends. And then starting to introduce as a guest, because that's another whole area, of course, is guesting, to introduce other orchestras to these ideas. And then really quite late on to have a modern orchestra in Stuttgart and a chamber orchestra in Salzburg where you could treat them as if they are the London Classical Players, and you know, another whole series of amazing sounds emerges. You know, you hear for the first time you hear Elgar Enigma as it might have been heard in the early part of the 20th century. The first time you hear Tchaikovsky 6, you know, first time you hear Mahler 9. Amazing new sounds emerge just because you're ploughing this quiet furrow of so-called authenticity.
And eliminating vibrato.
Yes, well, that's
where did that preoccupation come from?
Well, just from finding out how they used to play. I mean, it's all the sources say we don't use vibrato except as a decoration in the 18th century and all through the 19th century until the very beginning of the 20th. And the last one, I suppose, to make a big point of it, is Joachim, who premiered the violin concerto with Brahms. And in 1904, his book comes out, in English and German, side by side. And he says, vibrato is a decoration. If you use it all the time, you are showing the world you cannot play the instrument. And another point of his was that it's a substitute for real feeling. So that's 1904. Mahler's brother-in-law, Arlose, was concertmaster of Vienna Philharmonic until 30 years after his brother-in-law died, and never accepted vibrato. So, I mean, Vienna went on playing until 38, you know, that famous recording of Mahler 9 with Walter. So, clearly, this is a major part of the sound of the 19th century music and early 20th century music. So it has to be of interest, just like, you know, the number of violins in Haydn Symphony or whatever it is. I mean, every point is relevant. So I had no idea it went up to Mahler when I was doing Beethoven and then when I was doing Schumann and then got to Brahms. And, you know, every time you moved on, you realised that it wasn't relevant.
But you can't eliminate it altogether. You do need vibrato here and there, if only for the strings to give them a bit of self-expression.
Well, you can. I mean, the fact is they didn't. I mean, if you listen to recordings, I mean, they just didn't do it. And particularly the wind didn't do it. So, I mean, the challenge in the last 10 years has been, can a modern orchestra play with virtually no vibrato, certainly not thinking about it as something they do, and make the music work? And I have to say, I think they've showed that it can. But,
do you allow singers to vibrate a bit?
I would much rather they didn't. I mean, bel canto was a pure tone experience. And indeed, the early recording, I mean, Patti and Melba, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's absolutely pure. So, I mean, it's all in the melting pot at the moment. I'm wanting to show it can be done without, really virtually without any, in orchestras and choirs. But soloists, it would be nice if they, violins or singers, if they started with pure tone and added it for decorative purposes, and not this sort of carpet, which we're all used to so much that we don't seem to object to it. Although if you talk to audiences, you know, they're saying, oh, I can't listen to opera nowadays, you know. I take that point.
So you'd like us to be vibrato-free and sugar-free, smoke-free. Behind the very open and engaging consultative facade, there's something a little bit prescriptive about you.
Oh, yes. I mean, all music making is prescriptive. It isn't a free-for-all. And I mean, I don't think about it as no vibrato. We call it pure tone, which is what they call it, reine Ton. Mm. And it's only the beginning of how you play the music. That's the, as it were, the instrument that you play on. What that gives you the opportunity to do is huge amounts of phrasing, gesture, meaning, and passion. I mean, it increases the passion. And I'm not about taking things away so that it's stripped bare, you know, and I want the Mahler 9 to sound terrifying because it's played like that, not sort of safe or something, you know. The same with Beethoven, you know, if you go at those speeds, it's absolutely wild, but that happens to be what he wanted. He knew perfectly well what he wanted. So, you know, it's highly prescriptive, I would say, but it's a serious attempt to get nearer to the composer, you know. I like to imagine Mozart coming into the back of a rehearsal and saying, they've got it. That's it. I mean, he might also like somebody else's performance. There isn't only one way to do it. But it has to tick enough of the boxes, you know. The tempo has to be near enough, the phrasing has to be near enough, the sound, the size of the orchestra. It's a challenge, constant challenge.
And a campaign.
And a campaign in a way, yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
Not bad to be still campaigning at 76.
No, it feels good. It feels good. And I mean, it may be that in 10 or 15 years' time, most orchestras will feel it a part of their options to be able to play like that.
The Norwegian League.
No, the historically informed league. But it may also not happen. There may be a reaction, you know. I may die like Hector beneath the walls of Troy, you know. But I don't care either way, really. I mean, I've given it my best go, you know, and most of the young conductors are very excited by this idea of the sound being much more malleable and open to phrasing and so on. So it may not work, but it's fun to have a point of view, you know.
It's nearly 20 years since you developed the brain tumour and melanoma.
Yeah.
And were told that you didn't have very long to live. When you received the news, were there a set of priorities for you, things that you had to do?
No.
Stay alive until your son was old enough? Or
yeah, good point, yeah. No, just keep going. Just carry on. And as soon as
did you know what you wanted to live for?
I'm never very good at long-term forward planning, you know. I've got these concerts in the next year and this is what I want to do with them and I just get on. Thinking a little bit further ahead, you know. It's only looking back that you find you've had a career. I don't have a career in front. Don't have a manager either. Perhaps that's why. But I just hoped I would be able to go on doing my work. And I've been very, very lucky that I have been able to, because it's really come together during that last 20 years. The kind of work and the interest that's grown in this sort of serious area of performance. So I've been very, very lucky to be able to pursue it.
Did God come into it at all? Did you have any dialogues?
No. No, I didn't have any dialogues with God. I did. I remember thinking when I was told the news, actually, I can remember having a sort of trying to get to sleep and thinking, OK, so have you achieved anything so far? And I thought of a few things that I had. I felt a lot better then. I thought, yeah, well, I haven't wasted my 58 years. I have actually done this and this and this, and I've lived, and if I've got to stop, then I've got to stop. But I felt sort of that something had happened. And from a very shy childhood, really, without any feeling of success at all at school and so on, the music had lifted me out of that, and I'd been able to put my trust in it, so to speak, and it had really given me the most wonderful opportunities. The confidence which performing music can give you. It's an extraordinary thing to be able to do, and the least you can do is to give it back to the audiences.
You once said that yours is a very English music life, that like Vaughan Williams, you just want to make yourself useful. But the world has changed since Vaughan Williams' day, when the grassroots needed constant watering. And you've seen it transformed in your lifetime. Today we have a flourishing musical country, some of the best orchestras in the world, thriving early music scene, contemporary composers of all kinds. Yeah. If you were 40 years younger today, Roger, what would you be doing now?
No idea. You've got to ask somebody 40 years younger, I think, because, you know, 40 years ago, it was clear where I was trying to go. So I find it very difficult to answer that question. It's so hypothetical. I mean, there's lots of things one hasn't done. I haven't done nearly as much modern music as I would like to. I need 40 or 50 premieres. That's a whole area that would have been interesting. There's all sorts of opera I haven't done. One of the other lives I could have had would have been General Musikdirektor of a big German opera.